Welcome to the Tech Money Podcast, where the worlds of technology and personal finance collide. Hosted by certified financial planner, speaker, blogger, and self-proclaimed personal finance nerd, Malcolm Etheridge. Each episode aims to make you just a little bit smarter about your money, all from the perspective of the tech professional. Without further delay, here's your host.
Hey there, listeners. Malcolm here. And on today's show, we're talking about investing. More specifically, we're talking about the dangers of allowing your emotions to guide your investment decisions and ways to help you ignore the impulse to take action every single time the stock market moves in either direction. The underlying theme of the stock market and the way it functions is that we are all rational actors in a rational world, acting on the very same publicly available information at the very same time. The assumption is that people will always, always, always make the right decisions, and that if they don't, it's only because they don't have the right information. But the reality is we are all irrational beings living in an irrational world, and we frequently do things that are against our own best interests, such as selling stocks during market crashes and locking in losses, or worrying about cutting our spending only when we have plenty of money and failing to prioritize saving when we don't have enough. However, for those who are able to silence that voice, telling them to act and act fast and instead stay disciplined in their approach, the stock market can be a very rewarding place. Now, I am by no means an expert on the subject of behavioral finance, and I didn't even take enough psychology classes in college to begin to fake it on this podcast. So I decided I better call up someone who is in order to have this conversation. Dr. Daniel Crosby is the Chief Behavioral Officer at Orion Solutions, where he specializes in studying the intersection between money, mindfulness, and meaning. Dan received both his Bachelor of Science and Doctorate at Brigham Young University, where he studied behavioral psychology. He has also written numerous books on behavioral finance, including The Behavioral Investor, The Laws of Wealth, and You're Not That Great, which, by the way, is one of my favorite book titles ever. Dan also hosts his own podcast called The Standard Deviations. And so with that brief introduction, welcome Dr. Dan Crosby to the Tech Money Podcast.
Malcolm, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you agreeing to come on and do this. This should be fun. To get us kicked off here, I breezed through your resume pretty quickly in my intro there. What else should I have included?
You know, you did a great job. I'm super proud of the work I've done in taking these behavioral concepts and try and make them sort of serve the masses. So it really, my books are the things that I'm most proud of. The Laws of Wealth and The Behavioral Investor, I think, are the best place for the average person to get a flavor of my work.
Yep.
But you know, there's over 200 different behavioral biases that have been documented, these deviations from rationality that you talked about at the outset. So that's, I think, a great place for folks to get a taste for a simplified version of how that applies to their lives.
So as I understand it, in doing prep work for this interview, I understand also that your dad was a financial planner, which is how you got interested in doing this work. But then you decided to go against following his shoes. What happened there?
My dad still is a financial advisor.
Okay.
He's still practicing and doing a great job. But yeah, I grew up in a house where we talked about investing around the dinner table. And I thought that was something that I would want to do professionally as well. So I set out to do that when I went to college. But in my first year of college, I absolutely fell in love with my psychology courses. Mm. After my first year of college, I spent 2 years abroad in Manila, Philippines, on a church service mission, and there just got even further immersed in a different culture, different ways of living, different ways of moving through the world, and just really became fascinated with human behavior and the human condition. So I came back with sort of a renewed interest in psychology, and then went on to get a PhD, but with an aim to be a clinical psychologist. But about halfway through that clinical psychology PhD, you know, I said, look, I love thinking deeply about why people do the things that they do, but I don't know that I want to do it in a medical context. And that's when my dad introduced me, without knowing it was called that, to the world of behavioral economics.
So stay there for a second. Can you just explain to us what behavioral economics is and how that work ties into personal finance?
Well, you actually did a great job of setting it up. So behavioral finance, which is a subset of behavioral economics, just studies financial markets that account for the messiness of human behavior. So just as you said in your intro, the original sort of econometric models were all based on this idea of utility maximization, which just basically says that people will always and in all cases act in their own best interests, which is certainly not the case. We see when people, you know, you laugh because you and I have probably done 20 stupid things today that didn't maximize utility. And so all that behavioral finance and behavioral economics are the study of finance or the study of economics in a way that accounts for ways in which human beings don't always act in their best interests.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, to your point about being in college and being introduced to this work at the right time, I came to learn about behavioral economics after I had already started my career in financial services. But I tell people, like, if I could actually go back and talk to myself in college when I made the decision to change my major and focus on business, I wish I had been able to tell me to minor at least in behavioral economics, because it's so fascinating to me how the human brain works sometimes, like how heuristics helps us great decisions during life or death situations where fight or flight are the only possible answers, but then they also sometimes help us make bad decisions about things like money or our health or certain social settings or whatever. So it is a very interesting science, a very interesting way to apply what you've learned in the psychology realm to me as well. So no, I'm certainly jealous that you got pointed in that direction at the very right time. But according to the textbooks that I read early in my career as a financial planner, right, behavioral finance focuses on explaining why investors often appear to lack self-control, right? You were talking about doing things against our own best interest 20 times a day, right? We're acting against our own best interest in making decisions based on things that are other than facts. And this is why the literal definition from one of my Kaplan textbooks that I found, I didn't write that, by the way, was about how it's important to study the way that investors lack self-control. But the question I guess I have buried in there with all of that lead up is, why do so many people make decisions regarding money that are inherently math problems, but they base them on everything but math?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer has a lot to do with how we've evolved. And you look at why do people make bad decisions about their health or about their money or anything else. And we human beings are wired for immediacy. You know, we are wired for immediate payoffs, and we are wired to maximize pleasure in the short term. So we do things like overspend and eat donuts that are pleasurable in the moment, but if taken too far, have deleterious long-term consequences. So, I mean, yeah, you eat that donut for the 10 minutes you're eating it, it feels absolutely amazing. But, you know, you eat a donut every day of your life for 40 years and you've got a problem potentially. And the same is true about money, whether it's trading in the short term or spending money when we should be saving money. It feels great for a minute to get that new pair of shoes or, you know, whatever it is that you want. But you wake up 60 years old and suddenly you have a problem. And so we have to really do things that don't come naturally to us at all if we're going to be good investors and even good savers, because all of the brain research on saving, something as simple as setting aside money, shows that from a neurological level, we perceive it as a loss. You know, you saving $100 and you spending $100 have the same sort of impact on the brain, but in one case you have a new pair of shoes and in the other case you've got effectively nothing, at least right now. So it's everything we're asked to do is really, really hard from sort of an evolutionary perspective. We're wired for certainty, we're wired for immediacy. Being a good investor requires you to think long term and to take on risk and uncertainty.
I like where you're going with that, because one of the most interesting or maybe even amazing things to me about investing in general is how counterintuitive the best investment advice actually is. As an example, the act of rebalancing feels pretty counterintuitive. You're essentially selling off some of your winners to buy more of your losers in a portfolio. But it's been proven time and time again that over a 10-year period, the investor who rebalances will undoubtedly outperform the one who doesn't. So it's interesting that as you say that, like, very few people do those sort of counterintuitive feeling things, but successful investors all do them.
Yeah. So this is the great investor Howard Marks refers to this as the perversity of risk, which is at a gut level, we feel the least risk when there is actually the most, and we feel the most when there is actually the least. So human beings have something called recency bias, which is we tend to project the immediate past into the future indefinitely. If I meet Malcolm and he's kind and generous and intelligent one time, I assume that the next time I meet him, he'll be all those same things again. And so when you ask people, like recent research into what people think the market will do for the next 10 years, well, people think the market will get 17% a year annualized for the next 10 years because that's what the market has done for the last few years. And so the tricky thing about markets is the truest words in investing tend to be this too shall pass. Times of great abundance tend to be followed by times of more scarcity, and times of great scarcity tend to be followed by abundance. And so we're sort of wired to think that we should follow our gut. And in many endeavors, your gut serves you well. Like when you're trying to size up a new person that you've met, your intuition is probably right.
Yeah.
But when it comes to making investment decisions, your gut is almost 180 degrees of what you should do. And learning to ignore that and even run in the opposite direction, as you've suggested, is key to being a good investor.
Do you have any recommendations or sort of rules of thumb for how investors can force themselves to avoid the trap that is recency bias?
One of the best things that we can do is make our biases work for us. So we know that we are status quo prone. Like when we set something in place, we like to leave it. We're lazy. All these things that sound negative. But if you automate the process of withdrawing a little money every 2 weeks and investing it in a sensible way, you can actually use that status quo proneness and that laziness to your advantage and, wake up 20 or 30 years hence a millionaire. And so anytime you can take a behavioral tendency you have and make it work for you instead of against you, you're going to be in really good stead. So laziness, status quo proneness can lead you to never get started investing, but it can also lead you to stay invested once you get started, and it can help you to overcome some of that recency bias.
I saw an article in Barron's a few weeks ago where they interviewed an economics professor at Duke, and he said the way he keeps himself from acting on his impulse to trade during a down market is to enter in the wrong password a few times on his brokerage app so that the app locks him out, and then he can't get in to make any trades, so there's no point to even opening up the app anymore, and so he sort of forgets about it. And I thought that was a pretty good life hack. Like it's one of those things that, similar to automating, it's a life hack that helps us help ourselves.
So this is a great point. And again, to our previous conversation, when you think about what you want with respect to your money, you're like, I want transparency. I want ease of access. I want liquidity. Mm-hmm. All of these things that are ostensible goods and things that we would say we want fly in the face of us making good decisions. I give my wife sets the password for our online brokerage account. I can't get into it for that very same reason. And if we ever get a quarterly statement in paper, I tear it up and don't read it because I know that even though I've written 3 books on this stuff, I'm very anxious when it comes to my money, and most people are. And so I take pains to try and get out of my own way.
So if I understand you correctly, and I can put words in your mouth as you're talking and sort of sum up a little bit of where we just landed, it sounds like it's not necessarily about checking our emotions at the door. It's more creating these sort of barriers to entry in a way to help save ourselves from ourselves, to avoid those traps that are constantly prompting us to take action.
So that's nicely summarized. And if I can build on that a little bit, Every decision that you make is emotional. We know this from the research. Even folks who have traumatic brain injuries and have the emotional processing centers of their brains damaged, they have trouble making the most inconsequential decisions. They can't pick out which flavor of ice cream they want, because even a decision that low stakes has an emotional substrate to it. So we're always going to be emotional. And what's amazing is we're more emotional about money than anything else. When we look at the brain scan literature, folks are more activated by money than even sex, death, like other things that have strong excitatory power. Money has more excitatory power than even those sort of high profile, scary or exciting things to think about. And so our intentions are always going to be pure, right? We have the right will, we have the right desires, but our emotions are going to override those unless we put practical blocks in place that keep us from making bad decisions.
That is really interesting. One of my own like life hacks that I've used in the past and always share with an audience who asks me anything about baseline personal finance advice, I always tell the story of how, like, when I was getting started in my career, I opened up a savings account at a credit union that is like inconveniently far away from where I live. And the only, I had a part of my paycheck direct deposited directly into that account every time I got paid, but I didn't sign up for online banking. I didn't even have any checks for this account. And so the only way that I could actually get money out of this account was to physically drive the 50 miles or whatever it took to get to this credit union when I needed money. And realistically, because, you know, banker's hours, by the time I could actually get off work and get to this place early enough to get the money out, I'd already decided, like, either it wasn't really an emergency anymore, or I figured out a different way to settle it. And it's like those little things that we have to rely on to, again, save ourselves from ourselves.
I suggest that people put at least three layers of protection in place. And I call it my three E's. The first is education, right? Mm-hmm. That's important. We need to know how capital markets work. We need to know about how human behavior interfaces with the way we think about money. But education is necessary, but not sufficient, because of something called the knowing-doing gap. We know that in the US, doctors and nurses smoke at a higher rate than the general public. So, like, these people who spend their whole lives studying, you know, what makes you healthy, and spend their whole lives helping other people get healthy, leave the office and do something profoundly unhealthy. And the same, I'm not picking on anybody, the same thing's true of all of us in different respects. So the second piece is the environment. And that's a lot of the things we've talked about. Having throwing away the key, throwing away the password, making your bank hard to get to, having a portfolio asset allocation that is, you know, conservative enough that you're not going to get rocked off the boat because of volatility. And then the last E is encouragement, which is having that financial advisor, having that coach in your corner who can help you, keep you on the straight and narrow path, even when you're scared. And if you have those three things, if you know what you ought to do, you create an environment that's conducive to doing what you know is right, and then you put someone else in your corner, you're going to really, really up the odds of getting where you need to go.
So another thing I wanted to talk to you about in getting prepared for this interview, I did some reading and came across an interview that you did regarding COVID quarantine and the ways the pandemic has affected our money mindset. And so could you give us a little bit about that? What have you noticed that has changed with regard to our money mindset over the past couple of years?
So, you know, I live here in Atlanta, and at the height of COVID, Calls to mental health crisis lines in Atlanta were up 400%.
Wow.
And this was seen across the world. That you saw similar stats in London and other places where we observed this. And, you know, there was COVID was complicated. The fallout, the response was complicated. But one of the primary things that we saw was loneliness and just relational disconnectedness. And we know that loneliness has a profound impact on our wellness, our physical wellness even. People who are lonely are the physical effects of loneliness are twice as damaging as obesity. It's the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. I mean, it's just really bad for you to be disconnected from people. And all of us were disconnected from people for varying lengths of time and to varying degrees, depending on, you know, where you lived and how you handled it. But you saw this play out in the markets. And what you saw was these investing collectives begin to emerge. And you know, with some of the meme stock trading and some of the really extraordinary behavior we saw there, you saw people forming online collectives and sort of banding together in this, you know, this remote way to try and do what they thought was some good in the world. And the narrative that emerged was basically, we could invest in a way that sticks it to the powers that be and get rich in the process. And you saw a lot of that from people whose lives had been completely de-risked. You know, we were all stuck in our houses. You couldn't bet on sports because there were no sports. You know, people want a little bit of intrigue. They want a little bit of risk in their lives. And you saw some really insane risk-taking emerge in the markets when other elements of risk-taking had been taken from their lives.
Yeah, it even became cool to show how much money you lost taking a position in a stock.
Yeah, a symbol of sort of being part of the crowd, you know, having diamond hands, as it were.
Are you seeing things go back to quote-unquote normal at all already, or is it still too early to tell since we're technically still in, you know, this?
It's interesting because just this week, just the week that we're talking here, we've had a resurgence in some of these tech stock, these meme stock names, and a couple of them were halted today because of the extraordinary volatility. So I do think things are getting back to normal. I do think sort of our mental health is returning back to where it was before. But in some ways, there's no way to unlearn the things that we learned during COVID. And I do think the world is forever changed in some ways. But I do expect that as we begin to live more normal lives, these things will start to normalize. You know, we even saw this in driving behavior last year. In 2021, people drove at about 80% of the level that they did pre-COVID. And yet traffic accidents were about 125% of what they were pre-COVID. Wow. And so this anger, this frustration, this aggression, this risk-taking is emerging in new ways. And you're really not just imagining that people are driving worse or that they're grumpier on airplanes. They really are.
That you may have just sort of reshaped or reframed the way that I was thinking about this whole thing. Like, to me, the financial news and, you know, various documentaries and all kind of stuff that's come out has tried to rationalize meme stock mania by saying, you know, that younger people were fed up with the house always winning and Wall Street taking from the poor and giving to the rich. And to me, I really just didn't think it was that deep. I thought since sports were on hold, and that means sports betting was on hold, people turn their attention to the stock market because it was the next place that had the lights and sounds dinging and chirping like being in a casino. And once, you know, those with a large enough social media following made enough noise, it just attracted the attention of everybody else. But I think what you're saying is interesting, that that's a more of a natural human instinct and a more human response to being isolated and that sort of thing, is that it creates more aggressive and risky risk-taking behavior, if I'm understanding you right.
Yeah, no, I think you've got it. The other thing, I think we know that narratives move markets, and the narrative behind the meme stocks was so incredible. It reminds me a bit of the of the narrative behind Tesla as a brand. And of mm-hmm. course, Tesla has had an incredible rise as a company. If you think about, if you drive a Tesla, you can say a couple of things simultaneously. You can say, you know, I'm sort of tech savvy. Mm-hmm. You can say I'm rich because Teslas are expensive. Mm-hmm. And you can say, I give a darn about the earth. So anytime you can position yourself in a way that shows simultaneously some sort of righteousness, yes. as well as some wealth, because usually when people boast about their wealth, it's done in sort of an obnoxious way. That's sort of how we think of it. But if you can get rich and do it in a pro-social sort of righteous way, that's a powerful 1-2 narrative. Mm. And that is definitely how the meme stock thing was positioned. Let's stick it to Wall Street. We're all going to get fabulously rich in the process. And it's hard to beat that in terms of a compelling narrative.
Yeah. And so I was actually thinking about it in past tense, and I probably just referred to meme stock mania, the Wall Street Bets craze in past tense just now. But you're right that we're starting to see spikes of this every couple of weeks. Like if we just look at AMC and GameStop and names like that, that are the favorites of this collective. I was thinking that we're beyond this because I personally, in my day job, no longer have clients calling me up trying to give me their stock suggestions or asking me to explain to them for a fourth time what Bitcoin is. So I thought the hysteria was over, but to your point, it seems like it has these spikes where suddenly we're turning our attention there again. Is that sort of just, you know, folks trying to hold on to the fun that they had? Or is that, you know, are we not so much out of the pandemic and the pandemic induced loneliness that we thought? Like, is there a deeper issue there? Or is it just folks having a hard time letting go of a fun thing?
You know, I think it's there's some nostalgia there now.
Yeah.
And, you know, far from, I had Spencer Jacob on my podcast, who wrote the definitive book. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter, and he wrote the definitive book about meme stock investing. And the other thing that you're going to see is, contrary to the narrative that this is all folks trading from their parents' basements or whatever, and, you know, trying to get rich with their allowance money, there was some big money in on this. And there was big institutional investors who noticed these trends and tried to take advantage of them. So I think you've got a very complicated thing now. You've got certainly plenty of retail investors who are still compelled by this narrative or nostalgic or trying to make their money back, as the case may be. But then you've also got huge hedge funds and institutional investors who have seen anytime there's volatility, there's going to be winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, the smart money is going to come out on top. So I'm sure there's tons of huge institutions and things that have their ears perked at this new development as well.
Yeah, to that end, more the institutional side or the professionalized side of it, I've also been getting the emails and phone calls the last few weeks, or really all 2022, basically, since the market has been down, you know, pretty significantly. And all of the high-flying tech stocks that made trading look so easy have cratered, or they've had their, you know, day of reckoning, and maybe they're recovering now. But like, I'm getting hit up by people I spoke to over a year ago who ultimately decided they didn't want to hire a financial planner because they didn't want to be told what they could or couldn't or shouldn't do with their money. And now that things have gone awry, they're beginning to rethink a little bit. And since I know you do quite a bit of work with financial professionals in your day job, I'll ask you this. What can financial planners like me be doing or saying to the general public that'll help them save themselves from themselves? Again, you see a recurring theme, but in these types of situations, because we'll inevitably have another mass hysteria event like this in the coming years and then just rinse and repeat. Or said another way, is there a right way to help guard people from overconfidence bias, to use another proper term here, and believing too much in their own unproven abilities? Or do we all need to go through the experience of riding high and losing a substantial sum in order to have an appreciation for the patience and due diligence and professional research and such?
Well, it's a great question, because we sit sort of on the precipice of a really unique moment in terms of mom and pop investors, mm-hmm. because millions of new investors. This is kind of a good news, bad news with this whole COVID investing mania. Millions of new investors entered the fray during the COVID meme stock investing mania. Mm-hmm. And disproportionately relative to history, they were black and brown folks, they were women, they were people who have been historically underrepresented among the investment community. So the good news is new folks are discovering investing and it's been by a large part folks who have been historically underserved by Wall Street. So mm-hmm. the bad news is many of these new investors learned about it in exactly the wrong way. Like they learned about it by getting their hat handed to them by super volatile stocks or learning the wrong lessons and sort of getting involved in super risky stuff.
Yeah.
So to the extent that some of these folks have now been chastened by the volatility of these super volatile names, I do think there's a moment now where we can say, okay, we have lots of new folks on board. They've seen the power of markets for good and ill. And now let's help educate them to do things the right way. So when we look at the research around why people choose not to work with financial professionals, mm-hmm. the number one thing that they say leads people away from working with a financial advisor is fear of judgment. Mm-hmm. Or fear mm-hmm. that they will be condescended to. So I think there's a danger that I'm frankly seeing in parts of the professional investing world where we look down our noses at these folks who just got into it and go, oh, look at you. Look, you made every dumb mistake in the book and you thought you were going to get rich and you didn't. Ha ha. And I mean, I think this is a time for us to extend a hand of fellowship, to lift people up, to educate, to teach them about the power of diversification and compounding and getting rich slowly. So I think this is a real moment, and I don't want us to blow it by being arrogant or condescending or failing to recognize the moment for what it could be.
I'm glad you framed it that way, because that was actually a reminder to me. I have to remind myself to sometimes, like, from this platform and from the perspective that I have as a certified financial planner, not to talk in ways that sound condescending like you're talking about, because I try to make sure that I approach things from a place of education first. But one of the things that I hear is I have to get myself together and then I'll call you, which is inherently counterintuitive, right? That's like the people who say they have to get their life together before they go to church. It flies in the face of what the actual outcome that you're trying to get is from where it'll be most beneficial. But to the point you were making, there's a study that was done in Canada that I am sure you're familiar with that shows where people who work with financial professionals actually end out with 2.7 times the wealth of those who don't. But my interpretation of that data is that the success has much less to do with that financial professional's investment prowess and more to do with making sure that clients actually get things done. Like, I could recommend to a client that they buy a mutual fund or ETF that outperforms the market by 1 or 2% every year, but that's far less valuable or additive to their overall net worth long term than me making sure that they check the box on making, you know, a $6,000 contribution to their IRA each year, for example. Would you agree with that assessment that that's where the real value that we should all be focusing on is?
Yeah, I do agree. And I love that study because it actually controlled for 50 different socioeconomic variables. So the group receiving financial advice and the group not receiving financial advice were compared to each other and sort of made apples to apples across, you know, things like salary and wages and things like that. So it was a fair comparison. And what's cool is at 5 years, the group that had an advisor had 1.5 times as much wealth. At mm-hmm. 10 years, they had twice as much wealth. At 15 years plus, they had 2.73 times as much wealth, as you suggested. And just like you suggested, when we drill down and look at the determinants that distinguish the one group from the other, it was really that those advisors kept the advised group in their seats and on the straight and narrow path 3 or 4 times in their life. And that's a weird thing to say because it shows that the advice an advisor provides can be lumpy. But you think about in the last 2 years, if your advisor kept you invested through March of 2020 and kept you around for the subsequent enormous gains. And then that advisor kept you invested this year. You know, the market was down. The NASDAQ was down about 20%. The S&P was down 12 or 13%. Mm-hmm. The S&P is down 3%, you know, as of this morning.
Yeah.
And so if that advisor had just held your hand and kept you steady and counseled you through those two things, odds are you will never repay them. You will. Mm. Those were make or break moments in your financial life. And if you did the wrong thing, there's no bouncing back from it. And if you did the right thing, you'll never be able to pay that advisor back. So that's what we find. People who work with financial advisors, they make more money to the tune of about 2.7 times, like you said, but they also are happier and they even have better marital communications. I just had someone on my podcast sharing her research that people who had an advisor had much higher levels of marital satisfaction and better marital communication, because money touches every part of our lives. And if we can get our money right, everything else sort of tends to fall in place.
Yeah. I can't think of a better ringing endorsement and a better high note to go out on. So I won't say much of anything to undo what you just did there, making the case for folks to actually get professional financial advice earlier on than they probably think they should or could afford to or would need to. I think the real modification or change really just comes from the other side of that, because the interesting thing about those stats you're laying out is that most financial planners will still fall into that trap of trying to woo would-be clients by talking about how great they are at managing portfolios and outperforming the market, which then goes against everything you and I just laid out and got folks excited about and on board with and everything else. But rather than chase, you know, that rabbit down that rabbit hole, I'll stop there and just say, you know, thank you to you, Dr. Dan, for coming on and doing this. This was great. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about you after this goes live?
Yeah, thank you again for having me. And thanks for all your preparation. My podcast is called The Standard Deviations Podcast. For everyday investors, my best book to read is probably The Laws of Wealth. And then I'm on Twitter at Daniel Crosby and on LinkedIn, Daniel Crosby, PhD.
Awesome. Well, with that, Eric with an A, why don't you go ahead and close us out, sir?
This has been a great podcast. I'm so excited about the fact that it has a rewind button, because there's so much to learn. I'm still kind of hung up on when Dr. Daniel was talking about taking 10 minutes to eat a donut. I've never taken 10 minutes to eat a donut in my life. I'd like to learn how to do that. Again, Dr. Daniel, thank you so much for being on the show. Malcolm, of course, thank you for facilitating and bringing him on the show. And our last thank you goes to you, the listening audience. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Tech Money Podcast with Malcolm Etheridge. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Malcolm comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. We humbly ask that you share this podcast and leave a review, as this will help others find the show. You can connect with Malcolm on social at Malcolm on Money. We'd love to hear from you and answer any questions you have, and you can do so by emailing them to podcast@techmoney.com. Thanks again for listening. For everyone at Tech Money, our hope is that this show helped make you a little smarter about your money.
This has been the Tech Money Podcast. For more information on today's topic, to review the show notes, or to catch up on past episodes, be sure to check out malcolmetheridge.com/podcast. And if you have an idea for a show topic that you'd like us to cover, or you want to send us feedback, the web address again is malcolmetheridge.com. You can also find Malcolm across all social media platforms at Malcolm on Money. This episode was written and created by Malcolm Etheridge, with the production, the editing, and sound controls powered by Proudmouth. This has been a Malcolm on Money original. Thank you for listening. The information shared in this recording and by its guests represents the views and opinions of the guests and does not represent the views or opinions of the host. This content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. This content is not, nor is it intended to be, a substitute for professional financial advice. It is always recommended that you seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your personal financial situation.